let's start our own thing. Let's start taking clients. We were clear and communicating to our, at least our bosses, that, hey, we were going to do this. And they said, sure, go for it. The obvious indicator of if it works, great. It may not work. And you guys tried it out. That's totally fine as long as you can get your day job done. And so was really lucky to have that kind of support.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Garun Goodspeed from Treaty Oak Financial Services, and we are going to dive into three big topics. The first of all is what it's like to prepare for an IPO if you're on a finance team and then just walk away just before the end. We're going to follow up with designing sales comp plans or sales compensation plans for sales teams. That's something I'm all over like a rash. I do that every quarter and I'm really looking forward to getting some tips because it doesn't always go the way I hope it would. And then finally, we're going to talk about Garun's own explosive success with his firm setting up this year, but already is off to a flying start for when maybe we're going to get some tips on how you successfully launch a fractional CFO business. So Garun, you're very welcome to the show. Before we get started, maybe you'd just like to tell the listeners something about you that not many people know.
Absolutely. And first, I'll start by thanking you for having me on. Thrilled to be here. Thrilled to share the floor with your audience. Something that a lot of people don't know about me is that I've been tracking every movie that I've seen since I was in high school. Right now, that count is at 637. Just checked this morning to prepare for this podcast. And so it's just a fun way for me to look back on and see how I rated movies in the past.
That shows true passion for your profession, I think, tracking and accounting of everything you've done. So I have to ask, do you just put the names in or do you put a score in or do you rank them or what's your system?
I'll put the names in, but I'm also very real with myself that while I do rank them 1 to 5, I'm not a movie critic. So I will typically allow things like how is my day going when I watch that movie come into play or who was I with? Was I having a good time? So it could be a great movie, but if I had a bad day, it got a bad rating. And there's not really much that we can do about that.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right. I wonder if I did, because when I remember being a teenager, I've been like extremely passionate about the lyrics in Diana Ross's music. And I'm sure if I listened to it again, I wouldn't be so interested in it. But at the time, it really meant something to me. So maybe it's a walk down memory lane for you to figure out like what you were really into it. Maybe it says more about your own life journey of it than about the film. I love that idea. Cool. So maybe, okay, let's set this up then and just establish a little bit before we start talking about your IPO experience. Just give us a brief view of how you got into accounting and where did you train and how did you get your first gig, etc. And then we'll start talking about IPO preparation.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pretty standard accounting journey. Grew up in Dallas, Texas, went to a small Christian school called Abilene Christian in Central Texas for college. Got my master's there and then went off to Big Four Accounting, did audit for PwC in Austin, Texas, and was there for a couple years. After doing a couple years there, came to the realization that maybe something like trying to climb the ladder at a public accounting firm wasn't for me. And so I started looking around. My previous manager at PwC, her name's Amy, she's amazing, had left PwC and gone to be the accounting manager at a tech legal company or a legal tech company called CS Disco in Austin. So I went and met up with her. She said, Garun, we have a job opening, but you shouldn't take it if what you're looking for is less time and less hours. The company was growing exponentially, and they were looking at doing a system migration from QuickBooks to NetSuite. So I didn't listen to her. I decided to apply, and she said, okay, then we'll have you. So I joined the team there, and yeah, that's how I ended up at CS Disco.
Okay, very interesting. So I guess you're starting off on a topic I can get excited about straight away, which is implementing NetSuite. Not many people do, and maybe I have a morbid fascination with the trials and tribulations of going from QuickBooks to NetSuite. So I guess that's the first thing that getting ready for IPO means, right? You need a big boy accounting system to get started with. So let's start there. Having done that migration, what did you learn from it? What were the good and bad things about doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the funny thing is that the idea of migrating a system, that's kind of a big check mark on the accounting operator's lifelong checklist. When you say that you've done that, means something, and for a big public company, it's now public, that's a lot of work. So I got to check that box, and that's part of what brought me to disco. I think some of the things that I learned, both good and bad, is you have to, before the system goes live, be prepared to fail. When it comes to doing uploads of transactions or getting all the vendors set up or getting all the customers set up, it's never going to be perfect. In fact, sometimes the audit log of my uploads would show 10 failures before you finally get that upload to go through. And some people call that miserable. I ended up thinking it was fun. Let's see how quickly we can get it in and how many tries it's going to take. It ended up being a lot of long nights, which you can say is good or bad. You learn a lot, but that doesn't mean you get to quit your day job. The day job was still running the company and getting the accounting and finance done, getting close done, working with customers, working with sales. But when that job is done at 5 p.m., you suddenly have to go work on the migration. And that migration took us about 3 to 6 months, depending on who on the team was involved. Obviously, the start of the engagement, you start mapping everything out, deciding which records you're going to do. We had Salesforce, so we were doing a live integration, two-way sync there. And then, yeah, we went live and woke up on the 1st of November, 2019, and we were in a new system.
Okay, awesome. So if you need, there's some reasons why you might never want to go to an ERP, but that's a really good reason why you would. And just to be aware of the level of effort, it's a reasonably big size project to get going with that. It's not something you can just switch over. So you want to have a really good reason to want to do that in the first place. And I guess the public markets and these guys just want to know, okay, that's just one of the check boxes. By the time you had got to CS Disco, what were the other big projects that you needed to look at in order to be able to go public? Had that mindset been there from the start? So had there been groundwork, or was there some sort of catch up to do?
Yeah, luckily there was no catch up. The company was in great position. Our VP of accounting, his name is Jeff, and Jeff had us in a great spot. Our CFO, Michael, had also been there for a couple years and had the finance and accounting departments running really well. One of the best things about my experience that I got at Disco that I'm coming to understand is very rare. So I consider myself pretty lucky on this front, is that Michael was really flexible on letting the accounting staff who are interested run around the company and get involved in cross-departmental initiatives. So I was pretty consistently involved in things like HR. Whenever payroll and HR meet, I owned payroll, procurement with the finance team, not typically an accounting role, but we owned a lot of the processes there. And then when it came to sales, the overlap with finance is pretty heavy in our line of work, especially, and the comp plans in particular, modeling those out, getting those distributed, communicating with the sales reps and making sure that they understood and were motivated was a pretty big part of my role in the first couple of years at Disco.
So maybe you can tell us a bit about the sales motion, like what sort of marketing sales was done and what was the scale of the team that you were working with there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Disco is a very interesting market. We call ourselves SaaS, and it is software as a service, but it is transactionally calculated and invoiced. Similar to AWS for users that use that or any kind of server space, you're not paying $10,000 a month for access. You're paying incrementally as you use the product, which is how we build our customers too. We also had an interesting customer structure where some law firms might procure at an individual city. So the Dallas office might use one tool, whereas the Seattle office uses another, and other firms might be using the same tool firm-wide. So we had to think through that, because when it comes to sales, they want to think in terms of territory or in terms of enterprise, or the boutique was another name for some of the firm sizes. We at finance had to understand that sales motion, had to understand the selling territories so that we could model out what a book of business looks like for a sales rep. In terms of size, we saw the sales team grow from 30 up to probably 60 individuals involved on like the account exec role. And on the SDR, BDR role, we saw that grow from 10 to, I want to say, got up to 60. So the sales team grew very quickly and very heavily, which was a strain on resources, but also the way that we were able to grow as fast as we did.
Yeah. I guess we better color in here a little bit on actually what the product is, because you're saying it's SaaS, but it's usage-based, and that brings up challenges in a number of ways. We'll get to in a minute, but maybe you could just give us a layman's of what it is these law firms were buying and why they were buying it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do my best. I'm no product expert, but I did see it a few times. Yeah. So what CS Disco has as its main product product is an e-discovery tool. So when you think about in the movies or you've seen lawyers get piles and piles of papers stacked on their desk when it comes for a lawyer to review the discovery documents, now all of that is software-based. And depending on how powerful the tool is that you're using, you can use keyword searches or phrasing searches, or now DISCO has AI enabled. So you might be searching for one phrase, but the tool is smart enough to know that these other five phrases might get you the same result. It brings all those documents to the top of the lawyer's queue so that they can review what's necessary to bring the right facts and figures to the case.
Okay. And is this, it's not case law? This is like documents from other firms that have created all this mountains of documents and then someone else has to consume it on the other side, or?
Well, it's more like the documents involved in the trying of a case. So if a company is being sued by another company and their documents that are involved in the case include a bunch of emails or PDFs or Slack messages, as the world grows in its online presence, the documentation grows as well. And so you would ingest, is our word, all of those documents into the tool. And then that would be your basis of all the documents that the lawyer should, in theory, be able to review and bring to the case.
Okay. So you mentioned it's usage-based. So was it per search or what, how, because we'll get to the sales team in a minute here, but I just want to understand, like, why is it usage-based? Why didn't they just pay like a fixed monthly or annual fee like most SaaS businesses do?
Good question. So the incumbents in the space were license-based. So depending on how many users you had using the tool, that's how much you're going to be charged. But when you think about it, the cost to the business is not how many licenses there are. Like most SaaS companies, the main COGS line is the server. So the server space is driven by how many gigabytes are in the system and how many gigabytes are being constantly tapped by the server to consume that processing power. And so when we went to market at DISCO, and this obviously predates me, the pricing model was on how many gigabytes are in the system and being used by you, the lawyer, or you, the company's legal team, and then we'd bill out on that. So a typical invoice would read, last month, you had 100 gigabytes and your price per gigabyte was $40. So here's your $4,000 invoice. And we'd go like that. Now, the complications of the business become that you, the lawyer, doesn't have just one case. You've got multiple cases. And so we're going to bill all of those individually.
Okay, I can see straight away, this presents a business challenge because you can do all the work in doing sales work with a lawyer, law firm, but you get them in, you buy them steaks and whatever you have to do to try and get them over the line, give them demos, and then they say, yeah, we'll use it. And it sits there and they do nothing. Actually getting them, it's good from a customer perspective because they align the value with what they're paying. But you, Mr. Sales Comp Designer, has to get someone in and decide what happens if you get 20 people in and none of them buy. So how did you approach that? Use historical averages, or were the salespeople expected to go the extra mile to make sure that people actually use the product?
You are tapping the critical point of what the sales comp plan major pain point was, which is you can do an amazing job, have an amazing month, sign up five brand new law firms, but until they use it, DISCO doesn't get paid and we don't have the cash to pay you your commission check. Okay. So the usage-based model more or less mirrored the sales comp plan, where we would say, we will pay you X percent of what we collect or what we bill out to those customers. And so you, the sales rep, might be thinking like, I'm going to have a really hot start, sign up a bunch of customers, but no matter how many you sign up, it matters how much they're using it. So it's almost a double-sided sale where you're both trying to get them to sign up for the product and get them to immediately ingest all those documents. Now, some people might have those documents ready. You could reach out to a lawyer who's a little bit panicky and has their case that's going to trial next month. So they're ready. They've got all those documents ready that they need to start reviewing. But oftentimes the lawyers would say, I just want a case. I don't even have the documents ready or sent to the law firm. And we're probably a year out from this thing going to trial. So I'm going to be a little bit slow on ingesting. And at that point, we love to have them and can show them the product and say, here's what it's going to look like whenever you come on board. But we do all of that work knowing that they may not be using it for a few months.
So I can imagine you hire a really good sales guy, top hunter, let's call him. He's out there. He's doing bang the doors, getting or she's getting the door, you know, the business in, signing them up, and then tweeny birds. But sales guys need to eat. They can't wait around for 6 or 12 months, or sometimes these cases could be 5 years before they really get going. How do you keep the sales guys keen and motivated if it might take like any amount of time for the actual usage to come in?
And you would think a traditional accountant wouldn't have to be involved in the creativity, at least not early in the career, but that's what you're describing is something that we had to do and adopt. you can get a hotshot sales rep who you had to pull from another company, and building their book of business is going to be slow because that's the nature of the business. So the creativity comes into play because we would send them out on different incentives. So maybe in the first quarter of the year, we target that corporations and their legal departments are actually something that is high value for the company because they can ingest documents immediately. So maybe instead of going to law firms, we're going to say, you know what, here's the X amount of bonus just to get a corporation to sign their contract. And then we'll still give you that incremental commissions on a monthly basis for their usage after the fact. So we would run spiff plans probably, I want to say, 2 or 3 times a year for the reason that you described. It's keeping those sales reps motivated. And when I think about it, the conversations that I would have with the sales team and understanding their motivations is something that is directly translated into what I do now. Like, accountants aren't taught or necessarily depended on to be good at communicating. But getting that experience and understanding that I need to meet someone with where they're at, and I might have different motivations, protecting the company's finances, not overpaying, not prepaying, but I need to communicate in a way that holds our sales staff to a high bar and motivates them to keep on doing what they need to do to put food on the table and be hungry. A good sales rep is someone who loves to get paid and is going to work and benefit the company by doing it.
I've never had a sales comp plan that didn't come and bite me in the ass at some stage. A lot of unintended consequences. Inevitably, you start comping people on dials, and next thing you've got loads of dials, no calls. You start comping people on closed deals, and they don't build up their pipeline. How do you guard against that? Were there any unintended consequences you had to guard against, and how did you do it?
A lot of sales comp plans is the pre-planning. So ideally, you're able to catch all of that stuff before you put anything down on paper. One of the best partnerships we had at Disco was with our business intelligence team. And so typically, you think about business intelligence as a external facing function. They're going to watch what the customer does in the product. They're going to watch how the customers sign their contracts. They're going to watch how the product is interacting, COGS to revenue, those kind of analysis. But our BI team was able to double back into top of the pipeline metrics and see how is our sales team, how's our BDR team functioning up top, and we can catch those things quicker. And if that meant that we were adjusting the comp plan in the middle of the year, then that's what we would do. If we identified something that was new in the comp plan that was working, we would double down on it. Or if we identified calls but no results, then we would say, okay, we're going to trim that out and put more emphasis on closed wins.
Did those comp plans, did the sales reps know, okay, there's going to be a new one every quarter? Or there's an expectation, oh, I got this stuff last quarter, I'm going to keep on to that next quarter? Or how did you organize the expectation around what the comp plan was going to be?
Yeah, the expectation was always annual. And oftentimes several times in my tenure, we would reissue comp plans at the halfway point. Reissuing a comp plan can be difficult and can be stressful because you have sales reps who have modeled out their personal budget and their year against a comp plan, and you're yanking that away and giving them something new. So you had to be prepared for what's that conversation going to look like and how do you keep them motivated at the same time as going to an underperforming rep and saying, hey, we can throw out all that junk from the first half of the year and do a hard reset and give you a better chance to succeed in the second half.
Yeah, that sounds very challenging. Like, I wouldn't like moving the goalposts with a sales team or anyone, let's face it, can be very annoying if you don't get it right. And did you ever find yourself in a situation where you needed to do that retrospectively, or did you always honor, okay, we're here now and we're changing it? What caused those changes? Was it you just realized, okay, we didn't realize something, or did the company direction change, or were the sales reps doing something that shouldn't be done? What was the motivation between having to change the rep in the middle of the year or the comp plan in the middle of the year?
Yeah, sure. So luckily for us, we never ran into anything nefarious or anything fraudulent where someone was manipulating a plan. I hear those stories and I see those stories, and that can definitely keep a finance person up at night thinking about how something could get taken advantage of, but we never had to run into that. Now, I was in the role in 2020 through 2024, and we saw a pandemic, we saw an IPO. And so both of those major events would cause us to readdress our comp plans and say, okay, the landscape is now different. Let's double down on motivating our sales reps and find some of those levers that can grow that top line.
What other experience did you gather in preparation for that IPO?
Yeah, so an IPO is also it's on the checklist of every accountant's dreams, getting to see an S1. I was actually lucky enough to go to New York with the team and be there for the ringing of the bell. And and you learn a lot. We told ourselves, I never fact-checked this, but we were one of the fastest IPOs in history. It was conversations really picking up steam in the first quarter of 2021, and we went public in July of 2021. The number of steps involved in going public, at least the way we did, is incredible. And so you have to restate financials going backwards. You don't have to restate, but you did have to break apart quarters that we had presented. We had audited financials, but not on a quarterly basis that we needed. And again, you're having to manage your day job. The company has to keep going. And so your night job becomes all of the S1 preparation, working with the auditors on new workflows and things like that. So the main thing that the IPO taught me is how many hands have to be ready to do all that work. Now, we didn't have a ton of experience on the team around what it means and what it takes logistically to pull off an IPO. And I'd assume most companies don't have that. And so what you do is you pull in a lot of consultants. And that's not uncommon for a company, but it was somewhat uncommon for us. We were used to doing everything ourselves and we took pride in that. When you work with that many consultants in that short of time, you get a lot of exposure to, okay, what works, what doesn't work, what's incredibly good from a client experience and what you struggle with, what's a good line of communication and what's something that you wish would be different with that consultant. And so a lot of what I learned in that season and a lot of what started Ain't Nice Conversations to Come were, hey, the 20 to 40 consultants that we saw both in accounting and finance to pull off an IPO, but also in the procurement world company-wide, we know what's good and bad. We have all this experience now. What would it look like for us to take ourselves to market as consultants? And so we started those conversations very open-ended on, would someone be interested in talking to us about what we know? And we eventually found ourselves where we are today, which is running an accounting and finance firm and offering client services.
Very good. You're like so easy to interview. You're bringing the conversation exactly where we need to go. So it makes it perfect. So you built up all this great experience doing the IPO. You said, okay, this is something valuable other people can use. And now, so tell us a bit about the decision. Tell us about the personal motivation here. Surely having gone IPO, you would have been sitting pretty, I'm guessing, with all that experience in that business. I think life could have been easy and good for you where you were. So what made you want to step out? You had the experience, obviously, but what personally was a driver?
Yeah. So nothing pushed me out, right? This is me chasing the opportunity. I had an amazing team at Disco that was supporting me on the accounting side. I was operating as a controller, loved everyone above me, loved everyone below me. And it just came to the point in early 2023 when Amy and I caught up again. She had left, gone to another company, and we just started brainstorming this idea of, let's start our own thing. Let's start taking clients. We were clear in communicating to at least our bosses that, hey, we were going to do this. And they said, sure, go for it. The obvious indicator of, if it works, great. It may not work. And you guys tried it out. That's totally fine as long as you can get your day job done. And so was really lucky to have that kind of support. And then, yeah, the first few clients found us and said, tell me what you've been doing. And we say, we're CPAs, we're trained accountants, we're trained operators. And also we have seen legal, and also we've seen HR, and also we've seen payroll, and also we've seen finance, and also we've seen sales. And that sort of generality and diversity in experience is pretty valuable to all the startup tech companies here in Austin, which are looking to emulate what we got to do through an IPO at Disco.
So this is the same Amy that brought you into CS Disco. Now you guys are partnering up on your next venture. And that's interesting because in my own experience, like having a partner or someone you can work with well is the number one thing, like the number one indicator. Richard's my business partner and without him, I'd be nowhere. And it's very rare that you're able to do it all by yourself. Solopreneurship, not for me. So it's great that you had, but actually sometimes people ask me that advice. What would you advise? Find someone. And they say, how do you find a partner? So that you probably already know them. You probably know like someone school or college or whatever you just got on with. And then that's the biggest thing if you want to look for a partner to build a business with. So Austin is the trendiest startup place in the world right now, as far as I can see, as far as Joe Rogan says anyway, or Lex Fridman. So life seems pretty nice out there. With this experience then, what sort of client, what is the ideal client for you to work with now? Do they have to be looking for IPO themselves, or what's your chef's kiss perfect customer?
Yeah, no, the perfect customer is that pre-seed or series A type startup, somewhere that's in between one. We've gone even up to $30 million in terms of company size. That can be three founders in a garage all the way up to 100 people in an office. And the engagements can range, right? Because of the experience Amy and I have, we're able to say yes to an engagement where They just want help with investor relations. So we're drafting the board decks, working with investors and going to pitches. Or maybe they don't need that. That's a year away. And all they just want is solid accounting books that can one day be audited or reviewed by investors. So you're not wrong. Austin's an amazing spot to be for that. And we've been incredibly lucky just in the place that we're at. We haven't done any marketing. And so everything's been referral based. And our network has been able to support us in telling their friends, their founders, their old colleagues about these two people who are running around Austin trying to solve problems. And Amy, you're right, is an amazing partner. Having a partner, if I didn't, it would be impossible. She is so smart, works incredibly hard, is way, way better than me at any of the stuff that we take on. And that's always good to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you are.
Oh, very good. Well, make sure to send her this clip then. So she knows that. I'm sure she does already. But okay, so now you are, if I'm not wrong, you're already having started just a little less than 6 months ago. Is that right? In March? You're already up to double digits of clients. And I'm always a little bit suspicious when people say, oh, people just knew me and it all just happened for me, or people referred me and so on and so forth. So there must be something you're doing. You must be like, are you going to events, or do you stay in on a Thursday night? Or are you like, there must be something that's driving this. Or even for your own network to know that you are in business now, you spend time actively networking, or are you working LinkedIn? There must be something to get these clients.
Yeah, definitely. So the timeline was, we started taking clients in the summer of 23, and we were doing it on the side, managing those clients. By the end of the year, we probably had 4 or 5 under contract, and one of those was pretty big. And so that's what kind of pushed us to, okay, this is working. Went to our teams, told them that we're leaving. We can be flexible on leaving because we didn't want to burn those bridges. And both her company and my company asked for a little bit of an extension to get through the audits at the end of the year. So we helped manage the team, and then we started full time in the March, April range. In terms of like how clients have grown, one of our approaches, and it can be cliche for sure, is that customer service is without a doubt the most important thing in the services industry. You have to have very clean and very clear communications with them. And a lot of that communication can be reinforcing back to yourself that says, what am I doing this for? It's to serve the client. It's to make sure that they are in a good position financially to do what they need to do. And it's our job to take care of that. So when we think about like where our resources go, both mentally, but also financially, in terms of how we're growing our firm, we've actually poured a lot of that money back into our referral network. In terms of like someone refers us in, like the first thing I do is send them a thank you note and potentially a gift. And I say, you're the reason that we're able to grow. And so I'm going to take care of you. And I think another version of us would just go to Google and pour that money into Google Ads, or go pour money into some kind of outsourced BDR firm that is like sending out hundreds of emails a day trying to get new clients. But we would rather affirm the network that we have around us and let them know that our growth and success is a direct output of their support of us. And yeah. It has been a really awesome way to see it grow, because it just makes people more excited around us.
Okay, great. All right. I'm sure actually step A, be awesome, which is people need to do. But I got some tactic out of you there, which is, yeah, take a bit of time, acknowledge the people that help you, be a human and be polite. Texas, famous for politeness. Do you think there's something about Austin that makes people want to refer people there? Is that just a style of business that they have?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So when I think about like different networks, different places and how they operate, a little bit of it is experience and a little bit is what we've been told. For instance, the Dallas and Houston markets, you might go and find your outsourced controller or your outsourced accounting firm or your fractional CFO at a conference. You might want to go interview 5 or 6 different firms and compare their pricing and make a black and white decision. What we're finding out is that in Austin, what goes further than any of those more sterile interactions is calling up your friend that you used to work with 2 years ago at a different startup and saying, do you know anyone that works? And so more so than other markets, Austin seems to be a lot more referral based, where the barrier of entry is not how many people can we get in front of, or how many conferences do we go to, or how many cold outreaches do we do? It's how often are the people that are making decisions in the city talking about us and telling their friends about us? I think if we were based in a different location, we might have to take a different tactic and be a little bit more outgoing in terms of boots on the ground, showing up to places, or doing more of that cold outreach online and just being top of mind for everyone. But Austin seems to be a place that's a lot more relational in terms of where people go to look for those outsourced vendors.
Great. Yeah. And Treaty Oak is directly related to Austin, right? The name is inspired.
Yeah, I'd actually be curious to hear a little bit about your naming process. Our naming process was difficult. I mean, we went through hundreds of names and we landed on something that didn't have either of our personal names in it because we're not that self-confident. Other firms, you'll see themselves named after just some cheeky word that could work. So we could be like the expert accountant, something like that. But what we gravitated towards, what if we find something that is cool around the city? There's a historic tree in downtown Austin called the Treaty Oak. And so there's a few companies around town, a distillery, and a few other services firms that have gone after that name. And so we said, sure, let's do that. That has a nice ring to it.
Yeah, there's a very inside baseball joke now, but it famously in computer science, I'm a programming nerd by training, but I said there's only two problems in computer science. One is something called cache invalidation, which doesn't really matter what that is. Second is naming things. And I am horrible at naming things. We used to be called rubberstamp.io when we started. And the idea was you could approve things, stamp the approvals. And then we figured out halfway, no, in the US, that means don't really pay attention to what you're approving. I'm like, maybe that's not awesome. So we changed our name to Procurement Express. And it was the biggest mistake we ever made. It was so far anyway. Actually, I've got a bigger mistake. But once we did that, our sales literally halved overnight. And whatever we did wrong, I don't know. But we're back in a good spot now. But yeah, don't ask me about naming. All I know about it is I'm horrible at it. So you got good. You're tapping into that sort of good old boy. I don't know that you're getting that sort of vibe, that Austin vibe. You put your flag in the ground there. You got your referral network. It's a good vibe. It's pretty good. I'll come to you asking for help next thing on time I need to name something. I'm going to ask you how people can get in touch with you. You know, who should get in touch with you and how can they do that? And then we'll get on to our last question.
Sure. So most of the time people reach out to us whenever they feel like they're in dire straits on the financial or accounting front. And they just want to have that conversation, someone that can help manage those things. Oftentimes, founders are trying to do the accounting themselves in the background and run a company during the daytime. And we want to take that from them to enable them to grow their company. And it works for us. When our clients succeed, we're able to succeed with them. We can grow our practice based on how they grow. They can reach out to us through team@treatyoakco. So that's .co, not .com. And yeah, we can get in touch and just have a conversation. We try to be super generous with our time. If that means that we hop on a few calls and you just get to pick our brain about things that you're going through and things that you just need a few questions answered, like we're going to bank on the fact that we can answer that. And then 6 months later, you call us and you say, all right, let's start working together. I want you guys. And yeah, the ideal customer is really just anyone. We've turned a few customers away because they haven't been the right fit. And it's been cordial because we've said, here's someone that is working in your industry, or you're just a little bit too big for us. We think that you should go work with this group. And that's a happy referral that we're able to make. And yeah, that's been it.
Okay, great. Here we go. What everyone's been waiting for. Who is your business hero and why?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking about someone that was in my life growing up. Her name was April Anthony. She was a family friend of ours in the Dallas area. And she started out as a CPA and graduated from ACU, the same place that I went to college. She went to an accounting firm and then immediately branched that out into entrepreneurship and has been incredibly successful in that journey. And so from afar, I don't know a ton of the details, but what I did gather is that she was able to leverage her accounting and finance background into an entrepreneurship journey. And that's what I aim to do. And that's what I've been blessed to be able to accomplish as well. And so I think about it often in terms of how can I use my background in the discipline of accounting and finance to grow a company, because we don't want to just be a services firm where everything that we're able to accomplish is hinged on my ability to be online. We want the product of Treaty Oak to be our process and our customer service. And that's what allows us to grow. And that's what allows customers to find us. And that takes a lot more entrepreneurship as opposed to just being a hard worker. And keeping that top of mind has been a big driver of why we've been able to be successful so far.
Good. People in the finance, it's more common actually here in Europe for someone in the finance seat to go up to CEO or to identify an opportunity and then spin that out. Where my wife comes from in South Africa, just down the road, they live in a very rural place, but the accountant who is running a dog food factory there for them, dog food factory was doing horribly. He bought it from the owner. he put the dog food, he managed to get it onto like the local soap opera in South Africa, and the thing totally exploded. And next thing, bang, he's flying around in private jets. And this is in a Dust Bowl town in the middle of nowhere, literally. He's flying, he's a huge success. So I like that. I like that idea. You pick the person and you follow. If they can do it, I can do it. They're a CPA, I'm a CPA, I can do it. I like that a lot. Thanks very much, Karun. And thank you for listening. If you're still listening, congratulations. Your special reward for getting this far into the podcast is your ability to be able to sign up at procurementexpress.com/partners. There, I've recorded a webinar, especially if you're a finance professional and you want to learn more about how Procurement Express works and how you can help it to serve, how you can use it to serve your customers better. It's just for you, designed from the perspective of a fractional CFO who wants to know. And I've also got a case study in there from Ben de la Credes. He's one of our best partners, and I'll go through exactly how he introduces it to his clients, when to introduce it and when not. Congratulations, you've won that bonus for listening far. And thank you, Karun. This has been very interesting. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Wish you all the best.